Welcome to the B20 Legacy in Motion, a collaboration between Business Day and Sunday Times. I am Tiso Tsomotsweni, acting editor of Business Day, and your host for today. Joining me is Gulam Balim, chief economist and head of research at Standard Bank, to unpack the global dynamics shaping the B20 agenda and the ripple effects likely to be felt far beyond the summit. This episode dives into the intersection of policy, power, and progress. Essential listening to anyone invested in the forces driving international cooperation. Just to start things with, let's start with the budgeting process. As Standard Bank, sitting there and seeing all of this drama unfold, what is the thinking that's going in your mind? Because when the budget was delayed, I think it was hailed as as good for democracy, the heartbeat of democracy. So is there a risk that this could now be turned into some kind of a circus of some sort? How are you perceiving it as a Standard Bank?
I think the first observation that I'd like to make is that we have, like the rest of society, at least most of it, been favorably disposed to the government of national unity. And our sense is that it was a step lift and a material sense of evolution in terms of the capacity for more stable political dialogue. Mm. That assertion was against the backdrop that, at least for a decade, the foremost concern amongst the business community has been the political climate. And political climate, defined broadly, meaning government's execution of the bureaucracy, government in terms of policy making, and that going disarray, and also political climate enveloping state-owned entities. If you cluster all of those elements within the broad rubric of political climate, that, as I suggest, has been the most bedeviling concern amongst the business community. Yeah. And in fact, just for what it's worth, rank second would be aggregate demand in terms of signaling that consumer finances, consumer expenditure, consumer fundamentals hasn't been sufficient to really give a sense of a pending burgeoning in consumption. And the hesitation surrounding aggregate demand means that businesses don't really invest in a material way premised on, let's call it stable aggregate demand. So that's the first observation in terms of the macro relationship with the government of national unity and its aftermath. Prior to the budget dynamic, more recently, we also had the view that the GNU would prevail. We appreciate that there were many moments when the government of national unity seemed like it was on fragile ground and it could incinerate. But our sense was, the key protagonist, meaning Cyril Ramaphosa, the president, as an ANC leader, and Transnistria and the DA, and combined accounting for 60% of the seats in parliament, have more to gain from being in the government of national unity than out of it. Meaning, ideologically, the president, for example, could somewhat disentangle from the ideological restraints of the ANC and be co-opted into the ideological push that the DA would be leaning to. For example, another reason is President Ramaphosa would be somewhat unencumbered from the patronage pressures of the ANC by leaning to the GNU and having to subscribe to the type of governance frameworks that the DA perceive to lend itself to. So broadly speaking, I felt that as a preface to your question, getting near has its context, and therefore this is a very significant moment in the sense that maybe this is the sternest test of the GNU's solidity. Not that, previous occasions such as the Bella Act, yeah, and of course expropriation were not moments, but this could be, and seemingly today in particular, and seemingly this could be a moment of separation. Our sense is that the Democratic Alliance has more to lose from being outside of the government of national unity as well. They've certainly been on the right side of history in attempting to stave off any VAT increase, in our view, and by shifting focus on the expenditure side of the budget, I think has been entirely rational. They're also, through this process, exposed that the African National Congress clings to its muscle memory. Muscle memory meaning that it is accustomed to being in power and passing legislation almost as a formality. Muscle memory in the sense that the National Treasury always lurches towards tax policy to balance imbalances. And on this occasion, simply leveraging tax policy and particularly elevating that was not going to pass. I think in that respect, this was, you know, what I would broadly call creative destruction. Out of this clumsy process, out of this contention, had the potential to deliver a more constructive path in terms of public finances management and the cross-section of solutions that can be piped into the process. This was not there previously. The worrying thing, of course, is that, you know, the DA may be overplaying its hand to the extent that it is now also attempting to incubate non-budgetary issues in attempting to leverage the earlier stranglehold that it had both on the ANC and on the process. And of course, the ANC attempted to, in its own way, present its options and gaming the situation to for its advantage when it naturally lends itself to negotiations, which is, you know, not something that surprises us, and it's in the ordinary course. It's hard to say whether the GNU will prevail at this juncture, given the deep-seated nature of this fissure. Two, if the DA, for that matter, were to insert truly red lines that causes the DNs, the DA, unable to recant and swallow their pride, they've basically said, unlike previous occasions, or at least they've signaled, we're coming to a gunfight armed with a gun. And there's one dead body. And it's us, it's ANC, it's fat that could be compromised. It's, you know, in past episodes, they've come armed with a knife. And so the ability to recant, to acquiesce, was in a way easier because they knew they're not up for a very substantial confrontation, unlike on this occasion. Ideally, we would like to see the GNU continue. We'd like to see it preserved. The alternative in terms of policy uncertainty, and alongside policy uncertainty, perhaps worse, is a lurch where the ANC relies, say, on the Kondo Sizwe Party and or the economic freedom fighters. Mm. If that were the case, I think firstly, the business climate would sour, because many, justifiably or otherwise, have a view that both the MKP and the EFF are more populist in orientation, more compromising of the guardrails of society, more assailing of property rights, for instance. And in that respect, sapping the mood lift that we've enjoyed over the last few months would firstly instantly result in the financial markets convulsing. We've already seen the rand weaken today quite markedly from otherwise fair value favorable levels over the last couple of days and weeks, for instance. So convulsion of the financial markets would be the first signal that this is such an unappetizing direction. And of course, in due course, a hit both to inflation, in other words, potential elevated inflation risk transmitted through the rand, and in doing ensuing quarters, a hit to growth as the animal spirits in terms of investment in spending is further sapped. And so this is a very significant moment, and I hope the politicians see through their self-interest and reach compromise. Reach compromise. This is supposed to be President Ramaphosa's holy grail, his ability to negotiate fine settlements. Yeah. And I think it's equally up to him as it is to a seemingly thus far belligerent Democratic Alliance.
Wow, yeah. And now, because I remember you put out an Economic Outlook report in February. Given what you are seeing right now, I'm sure you are re-looking some of those numbers in terms of scenarios that could happen based on what you just outlined. Is that a fair assessment?
I think it'd be fair to say that there's been two shocks that have escalated more recently. I think the first is we did anticipate some level of instability in the external environment, premised on Donald Trump's ascendancy. And we've argued now for a length of time that globally, geoeconomic fragmentation, geopolitical fragmentation, and just a more contentious multilateral environment will be gross pressing. So global trade growth will be to the downside. What we have to calibrate for in the realm of the unknown is whether the trade wars will result in, or at least follow the formula of brief and substantial friction points, followed by settlements, and maybe even reserve, but then again, phases of settlements. In other words, the draining of concessions amongst parties, but overarchingly, a quick, relatively quick sense of new equilibrium emerges. And that would be the least damage to our prognosis from the exogenous shock. Of course, if it does morph into full-fledged trade wars, which is entirely plausible, we've seen a very strong muscular posture from Canada, for instance. A muscular posture from China would also be unsurprising, and even Mexico may lean into that level of assertiveness. And then suddenly the global growth outlook, for example, shifts from a prospect of near 3% global GDP growth for 2025 as the initial base assumption to a near 2% global GDP growth prognosis premised on more dire international affairs. So that's the first thing that I should just mention in recalibration our numbers. Of course, we, as I've suggested, had hoped that the GNU will, even if clumsily, experience bumps in the road, but broadly would prevail. If it were to collapse and if the political landscape suddenly becomes choked, then we go back to, if I could argue, the preceding 10 years, where, as I've said at the beginning, the political climate then resurfaces as being the most primal concern. And then we will probably be looking, instead of near 2% GDP growth as having been plausible for 2025, at the risk that it would instead fall to near 1% as a result of both the external and in idiosyncratic shocks.
I mean, with, I mean, just going back on the what's happening globally. So South Africa is the chair of the G20, and I know Standard Bank is heavily involved on the business side of things. Is there, can South Africa use this opportunity to try, as you say, I mean, with the trade war, there's a real possibility of a full-blown trade war here, judging by what Canada, how Canada has stood up. I mean, is there anything, if at all, that South Africa can do as a presidency, as a president of the G20? Do you see that position being strong enough to actually add a weighty voice?
To say so, South Africa has been bequeathed a truly majestic opportunity, admittedly, which is enormously ambitious. The G20 process, which lasts about a year, is one that is incredibly busy with a great amount of subtext to it. Most people, most citizens will be, for instance, just familiar with the end of the year meeting where the heads of state gather and sign off on a communique signaling progress over the past year and also potentially new themes for the ensuing year that a new country will adopt. But in fact, the G20 process is far more involved. Few people will be aware there's about 320 meetings, gatherings, engagements that take place that inform the process, and half of those take place offshore, half of it take place onshore. And the point I'm trying to just make is that the G20 mandate is substantial, it's busy, and it can be overwhelming in the normal course of the process. However, we now find ourselves in an environment where the rules-based order is being overturned, where America's centrality in global multilateralism is being withdrawn, where transatlantic ties are being frayed. And therefore, it suggests that the world seemingly is clamoring for more than just finessing at the margins with regard to sustainability of global affairs. It's attempting to almost rescue itself from a destruction of the rules as unfair as injustice oriented as they sometimes may be, that the world was familiar with it. So whether it's the United Nations, the WTO, the World Health Organization, IMF functioning, World Bank functioning, aid to countries that require it, all of this is being reset, and we're referring to it as a big reset. So South Africa has the capacity to be able to service the platform that in 2025 creates a situation where the global north, excluding the US, throws its arms around the global south. And the global south, in turn, reciprocates, where they develop what we would almost call a Johannesburg consensus. In other words, by the time the statesmen gather in November, which will happen to be in Johannesburg, a Johannesburg consensus that can mark a refashioning of this rules-based order premised on what is currently thematic and reinstall global commitment, even if for the moment it excludes the United States, which is difficult, but which excludes the United States by the United States' choice of extraction, that reinstalls commitment to a variety of issues, including, for example, climate change, which is one matter of global concern. So to your question about, it's as if South Africa is having to grasp a mandate far larger than it could have envisioned, because history and Donald Trump is dictating that. But it is out of sheer necessity that this needs to happen, because institutional dimensions are essential for prosperity, whether it is at a national or at a supranational level. I would just quickly say the task is incredibly daunting if we note that the initial gatherings of finance ministers and foreign ministers in early February or thereabouts wasn't well attended by key nations when it was held in Cape Town. And that somewhat, taints the legitimacy of the G20. And South Africa is going to have to try and overcome that, because it needs these voices, these G20 voices, to be participant for that commitment. If it doesn't happen, the world will be poorer for it. Indeed, and I think many nations will realize that, outside the United States in particular, that some level of guardrails needs to be reinstalled on the planet.
I mean, it couldn't have happened at the worst time. South Africa dealing in uncharted political territory. So you're dealing with domestic issues at the same time. You are there's this global order that's being relentlessly being challenged. Sometimes you could feel like, okay, that seems just the G20 is more of a distraction. We should be dealing with our own domestic issues. But I guess, this is where, as the country, we like I said, South Africa, we have to work out what is the most important. How can I how do I prioritize things here, international order or domestic issues?
So you're correct in underscoring again that this is incredibly daunting. It's going to prove deeply onerous. At the same time, this could be a moment for the type of leadership that South Africa has shown in critical times, in critical moments of our own history. The second observation I would make is the private sector is leaning in to aid the government enormously. You did speak earlier on about B20, business G20, and at the resources that can be harnessed there, which have already been, of course, as we know, harnessed for other endeavors such as electricity and transportation, even crime. So there is already an established ideological commitment to a partnership between the private sector and the public sector in South Africa for both domestic issues and now increasingly for international affairs through the B20 G20 arrangements. And so in that respect, I think that provides two reasons to believe this is a far reach that South Africa can actually execute. The third area that encourages me is the broader G20 membership, whether it is at the state level, the government level, or within the various substructures, such as the Business 20 grouping. I get a sense that firstly, there's experience there in participating in G20 endeavors, And there's also the political will to make this work, to kind of emerge out of 2025, aided, of course, by the South Africa platform, to deliver some level of stability, some level of guardrails, even if it is incomplete, but directionally positive compared to where we've gone over the last 2 to 3 months, particularly the last 2 months. So I think that there's enough political will, enough private sector facilitation to embed itself and provide scaffolding to the process, and maybe a readiness, general readiness to tackle it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Gulam. I appreciate it. Thank you.
So take care.
Bye bye. Thank you for joining me, Dise Tswemotsweneng, on the B20 Legacy in Motion, brought to you by Business Day and Sunday Times. This episode was made possible with the partnership of Standard Bank, a leader in driving economic insights and progress across Africa. Tune in next time as we continue to explore the forces shaping our world and the stories behind them. Thank you.